Cold Canvas Radio Show. Your home for the latest news in boxing, MMA, and pro wrestling with Big Al Brody on Sportsnet 650.
I'm going to tell y'all with a tear in my eye, this is the greatest moment in my life.
Woo! Let's give a big one!
Woo! Welcome, folks, to the Cold Canvas Radio Show. Big Al Brody, Brody El Toro here, coming at you all from 12 Kings Pub, Vancouver's one and only home of combat sports. And happy 2020 to you all. Right out the gate, I gotta say that there's nothing better than feeling fresh and looking sharp to start the new year. And thanks to my main man, Mo, and the whole crew down at New York Barbershop, I am feeling and I'm looking so fly. Hey, I'm like a G6. Spanish listeners, they started calling me Guapo. You got to check these guys out. They just opened up a brand new shop at 493 Davie Street. It is absolute class. Now, we are coming in white hot for today's episode. There's too much to discuss. And I feel like if I gab on too much, it's going to be like Canadian alternative rock group Default's 2001 breakout hit, and I'd have wasted my time and yours. So, the Notorious One made his triumphant and emphatic return at UFC 246, where he KO'd Cowboy Cerrone in just 40 seconds of the first round. I'm going to talk about that tilt and speculate what's next for Connor. Then you heard the Nature Boy's famous interview at the beginning of our show. Folks, it's January, and that means it's Rumble season. The Royal Rumble is coming up this Sunday, January the 26th, and the Cold Canvas has partnered up with 12 Kings Pub, and we are going to be presenting the card at 12 Kings, 395 Kingsway, on Sunday, January 26th. There's going to be trivia. There's going to be games and prizes, most notably tickets to an evening with hardcore legend Raven at the Rio Theater. That's right. Thanks to our good pals over at Got Pop Concert, two lucky prize winners are going to get the chance to check out that event. It's on the 30th of January. Now, Raven is one of the most honest and interesting dudes in the biz, and he's a guy who's really done it all. He's going to be sharing stories from his time spent in ECW, WCW, WWE, and everything in between. There will also be a meet and greet, an audience Q&A session, and if you're looking for tickets, hit up at Got Pop Concerts on Instagram. Just follow the link to their website. It is a 19-plus event. Doors are at 6 p.m. We have got Rumble Fever here. Wrestling Rob is stopping by to talk about the card and Royal Rumble's past. We're also going to do a little bit of Rumble trivia. And then we've got part four of our podcast series, The Night Sonny Liston Fought Cassius Clay. And then we were going to finish up the program with Coach Casey from Gracie Baja, continuing our series with the number one jiu-jitsu academy here in the city. New Year's is here, and it's Mental Health Awareness Day on the 29th. This is the best time to cash in on those New Year's resolutions to improve your physical and mental health and sign up in Gracie Baja. Nab yourself an entire free month of training just by mentioning that you heard about the club on the Cold Canvas Radio Show. All this and more coming right up. You don't want to start 2020 with an all-expensive paid trip to Dirt Nap City. So you best keep it locked to the Cold Canvas Radio Show right here on Sportsnet 650. Big Al Brody here. I'm always on the lookout for vintage clothing, and a few weeks back, I stumbled into the coolest shop in the city, Stocks Vintage. It's at 370 East Broadway. It's right inside the Kingsgate Mall. Every time I go into this place, I come out with something that I love. Shirts, sweaters, cardigans, hats, scarves, buttons, shoes, you name it, Stocks Vintage has racks and bundles of literally everything, and the prices are always unbelievable. The other day, I found an orange NASA sweater with all the Apollo mission crests on the sleeve, and every time I wear this thing, I can't walk down the street without five people stopping me and asking me where I got it. I tell them all I got it at the best vintage clothing and accessory store in the city, Stocks Vintage. You can hit them up on their Facebook page, at Stocks Vintage, that's with two X's. Check out their latest offers and items. Stocks is a Canadian company since 1998, and they are now here in Van City. Visit them today at the Kingsgate Mall and get ready to pop some tags at Stocks Vintage. Now that you are looking sharp and presentable, you're probably going to feel that tummy start grumbling. But don't fret,
because you're in luck. Frenchie's Restaurant, the home of the authentic Montreal poutine and smoked meat, is right around the corner on Broadway and Main Street. Grab a seat. Say bonjour to the little man, Michel. Maybe order Blanche de Chamblay. Hockey season is here, so you know the Habs will be on the screen. Listen, some of these other places, they're what the French call les incompetents when it comes to their poutines. They throw everything but their gam-gams pearl earrings on the darn things. Not Frenchies. You get a real authentic Montreal poutine with cheese curds and that world-famous Saint-Hubert gravy. Come nighttime when that thing is swimming around in your belly and those Habs are lighting up the red lamp like Rudolph's nose on a Christmas morning, you're gonna think you're on Church Street in Montreal, Quebec. It's the real deal.
And if you mention that you heard about Frenchie's Restaurant on the Cold Canvas Radio Show, you can upgrade your side to a poutine absolutely free. It's their way of saying merci, which means thank you.
Drop by Frenchie's Restaurant at 2470 Main Street tonight.
If you're looking for an authentic taste of Italia, Bellagio Cafe is the place. With two dazzling locations on Hornby Street and the Convention Center, Bellagio is open 7 days a week, 365 days a year for breakfast, brunch, lunch, and dinner. It's the perfect cafe for all occasions. Company parties, family gatherings, or romantic dinner, when you dine at Bellagio Cafe, you'll be met with a seamless blend of world charm and modern techniques. Bellagio also offers a world-class cocktail menu and delectable dessert options, happy hour appetizer and drink options, every day from 3 to 6 p.m. Bring your family and mention the Cold Canvas Radio Show, and your little bambinis will eat for 50% off. It's a limited time offer, so call and make your reservation, or simply drop by one of two Bellagio Cafe locations at 773 Hornby, directly across from the Art Gallery, or 1055 Canada Place Convention Center. Treat yourself to the taste of Italia at Bellagio Cafe. Ciao.
And welcome back to the Cold Canvas Radio Show, coming at you from 12 Kings Pub, Vancouver's one and only home of combat sports. And man, oh man, the king is back. And it only took him 40 seconds to reclaim his throne. The biggest name in combat sports since Mike Tyson, and maybe the most popular athlete going in sports today. I tell you something, I was working that evening, and I had to dash home to catch the fight. And it's a good thing I hustled, because had I had not driven a $1.20 through that school zone, I would have missed it. 40 seconds, round one. Conor McGregor with the KO, TKO victory over Cowboy Cerrone at UFC 246. I never had the chance to air my predictions for this one, and it's probably a good thing, because I would have looked like a Doomkopf, which is what my German grandmother called me as a little child. And that translates to useless, incompetent idiot. I had Cowboy winning the fight in the fourth, I'll be honest with you. I thought he'd be able to weather the early storm in rounds one and two, and McGregor would tire out in the championship rounds, like he has done in the past, and that Cowboy would secure a TKO by strikes. But that was not the case, not even close. Conor, instead, what he did was he shattered his schnoz in 15 seconds, like the toolbox did Marv from Home Alone 2, Lost in New York. And he did it with a shoulder shrug, of all things. Then he kicked him in the jaw, and he followed up with a flurry of punches to the ground before the ref stepped in, called a halt to the contest at 40 seconds. So McGregor took to the mic afterwards, and much like he was in the lead-up to this fight, he offered nothing but his utmost respect to Cowboy. He graciously thanked his opponent. And he also thanked the fans for sticking with him over the past turbulent year and a half. There was even a tender moment between he and Cowboy Cerrone's grandmother, whom apparently has formed a close bond with McGregor. They hugged. Everybody cried. It was the antithesis of the fallout of McGregor's last fight against Khabib. And I got to say, it was genuinely an awesome moment. I'm going to admit that I was not a Conor McGregor fan going into this. Wasn't exactly on his side, and like many others, I let kind of recent controversies and the tabloid stories sway me into believing that he wasn't the same fighter that he once was, and that fame and wealth and the whiskey had kind of extinguished his fighting spirit. But I was wrong, And I'm happy that I was wrong, because what we got to see was a beautiful redemption story play out live on Saturday night. And who in their right minds doesn't love a good redemption story, right? All of the greats from all categories of sports have this common arc in their tale. It's the story of Rocky III. And the haters and the pundits, people who have never met the person, they know nothing about their demons and personal struggles. They write them off. They villainize them in the media. But the exceptional ones, the true champions, they always prove these people wrong. Because it's one thing to get to the top of the mountain. It's another thing to fall off and climb back up. And McGregor now fits into this rare category of greatness. Love him or hate him, his impact and talent are unprecedented, and he is something special. He revealed after the fight that Cowboy's grandmother told him, it's easy to walk tall in the daylight. Now you need to walk tall in the moonlight. It's an inspiring quote. So much so that my dearest friend, Wrestling Rob, has since tattooed it in bold right next to his Aldo Montoya piece on his lower back. So, now comes the fun part. Who's next for Conor? Pretty much every fighter out there wants that payday. So many of them took to social media right after the fight to call out McGregor. The notables include Nate Diaz, Jorge Masvidal, Manny Pacquiao, Floyd Mayweather, and Khabib Nurmagomedov's father, who is demanding $100 million for a rematch to take place. So there's many options out there, but which one makes the most sense right now? Dana, he seems to think that Conor challenging the winner of Khabib Ferguson for the lightweight title is the most logical. I think that fight needs to happen. I think it will happen, but it doesn't need to happen right now. I think a Diaz trilogy is also inevitable, but that thing can also wait. That fight will always draw for as long as the two fighters are still active. And personally, I have more desire to go camping with Dennis Rader than to see Conor return to boxing. So scratch off Pacquiao and a rematch with Mayweather. I think what the UFC needs to do right now is strike when the iron is hot, and the hottest breakout star undeniably was Jorge Masvidal of 2019. And it should be Gamebred that gets that big payday next. From a media perspective, I think it makes the most sense to me. Both men are solid gold on the promotional side of things. And despite what the 2011 smash hit Price Tag by Jesse J featuring Bob says, the UFC is all about the money, money, money. So from a business point of view, I think this is the fight. And should Conor lose, let's look at it this way. Should Conor lose and say it's a close fight, it's at 170, it's not his weight class, and the demand to see him go back to 155 and challenge for the title, it's still going to be there. Now Jorge becomes an even bigger attraction. And what's better than one monster attraction at a theme park? Two. If the opposite takes place, Masvidal can still be a contender, he'll still be a draw in his weight class, and McGregor's list of potential opponents expands even further. McGregor versus Masvidal for the BMF title. I say make it happen. And Wrestling Rob, I hear there's a rumble coming. That's right. The Cold Canvas presents WWE's Royal Rumble coming at you Sunday, January 26th, right here at 12 Kings Pub. You're going to want to book ahead for this one because the Rumble is like St. Patrick's Day for wrestling fans, and things get pretty crazy down here at 12 Kings Pub. We're going to have trivia, prizes, special appearances. Last year, Tony Bennett popped by. He sang a few ditties. Tom Berenger made a surprise appearance. You can't smoke inside 12 Kings Pub, but good luck telling that to Mr. Tom Berenger. Yeah. I'm here with Wrestling Rob, as always. Let me ask you, Rob, what comes to mind the second you hear the words Royal Rumble?
For me, the first thing that comes to mind is those old, like, early 90s posters that they had. I remember being a kid going to Midnight Video back in New Brunswick and looking and trying to find those old school posters of the wrestlers walking down the alley together, and that's always kind of the first thing that comes to mind for me when I think of the Rumble.
For me, it's five words. It's not fair to Flair. 92, which in my opinion is not just the greatest Rumble, but maybe even my favorite match of all time. I revisit it probably twice a year, and every single time I watch it, I just marvel at the booking. I think it's a complete masterpiece. The commentary from Brain and Monsoon might be their finest hour together. It's absolutely hilarious. You got Flair coming in at number three, Brain having about 50 heart attacks throughout. Also, one thing I love about Monsoon and Brain, they are my favorite pairing of all time. But what I really love about them is that they make you believe that every entry really has a chance of winning the thing. So I remember watching this as a kid, and the way Bobby Heenan would just embellish mid-level talent on their way to the ring, it made you think that, hey, maybe the Barbarian really has a shot at this thing. Flair's performance, I mean, man, what's better than that, right? How many charging face plants does he take in this one? But all of them make sense. And the title was also on the line for this one, too, which is just the cherry on top. Robbie, do you have a favorite Rumble performance?
I'd have to go with Rey Mysterio when he went coast to coast. I believe it was 2006 that year. Unfortunately, Eddie Guerrero had passed away a few months before, and Rey and him were obviously very close. So I just remember he came out in the lowrider like Eddie Guerrero used to do, and it started with him and Triple H, and Rey Mysterio, lasted the whole way through, put on a heck of a performance, and ended up winning, and then he went off to WrestleMania to win the title that year, and I think that Rey Mysterio's Coast to Coast that year was hands down the best Rumble performance for me.
Yeah, the Rumble, of course, is all about surprises. You never know who's going to make their debut or in-ring return. What are some of your favorite surprise entrants from Royal Rumble history?
I think I'd have to go with AJ Styles' surprise debut at the Rumble. I remember he came in at number three that year, and there was a bit of a botch, I think, with the production where they kind of held on a tight shot on Roman Reigns' face, but then you just heard the crowd pop when the words, "I am phenomenal," came up on the big screen, and that was definitely the biggest surprise entrance for me out of any of the Rumbles.
How about Giant Gonzalez from 93? When he stared down The Undertaker and just completely dwarfed him, that was pretty shocking. I remember that as a kid. 8 feet tall, Gonzalez was. But unfortunately, I think it's safe to say that his in-ring abilities came up a little bit short. He was also dressed as if he just had raided Wrestling Rob's closet. But the moment was cool. And you know something? Kudos to Harvey Whippleman. I was thinking about this the other day. I don't think there's a manager in history that more thoroughly scoured the earth for talent than that guy. Every corner of the globe was represented with him. Gonzalez was from the Andes Mountains. Then you had Adam Baum. Harvey found him living on Three Mile Island. That is an evacuated site of a nuclear catastrophe.
His recruitment must have been really strong. Got a big budget to recruit our
Just think, guys. Adam Baum's rummage. What's he doing there? And then there was Quang, who was also, I believe, from Puerto Rico. Switching gears, what's your favorite singles match in Rumble history?
I'm going to stick on the AJ Styles train again here. This time it's from the Royal Rumble 2017. It was him against John Cena in that match, and that was actually the one when John Cena ended up winning. He ended up vanquishing AJ Styles after he'd got the better of him in the last few matches. And this one was also historic because it was the title reign that allowed John Cena to match your boy Ric Flair for his 16th world title reign. So that was a big one for me, and I remember that match being just a 5-star one from bell to bell. I really enjoyed it.
I gotta go Cactus Jack versus Triple H from 2000, and I know most of you out there are probably saying it's what a cliche to go with Rumble 92 and now this, but you know what? They're classics for good reasons. The McMahon-Helmsley faction at the time was terrorizing the WWE. They had humiliated and fired Mick Foley. The entire roster then revolted against them, and The Rock demanded that Mick be reinstated, which led to Mick challenging Triple H to a street fight, but he said he wasn't going to be taking on Mankind. He'd be taking on his infamous and sadistic alter ego, Cactus Jack, and bang, bang, we got a classic from those two at the Garden. I think both guys had kind of reached the pinnacle of their respective careers at this point. I think that this is kind of the match where the wave broke for Mick Foley. Not saying that he didn't have some great matches afterwards, but this is, for me, where the wave broke. From Hell in a Cell to 98 until this match, he was doing his best work. He put on a string of violent classics. And Triple H from 99 until he went down with that quad injury in 2001 is my favorite rendition of the game.
That was quad injury number one, I think, yeah? That guy's got some soft quads.
So you had two veterans that had paid their dues. They climbed the ranks the hard way, and they were headlining a Big Four pay-per-view. They had a few good matches in this feud, but this was the best of the bunch.
Yeah.
Obviously, the most infamous cited moment of Mick's career will always be Hell in the Cell. But I think that top to bottom, this was his best match, and it might even be Triple H's. I'm not a hardcore guy, but this storyline demanded violence. So the barbed wire, the thumbtacks, it all made sense to me on this one. And I don't think there's a wrestler out there that wears the crimson mask better than Triple H.
Well, I think your boy Ric Flair had the crimson mask down pretty well. With that bleached blonde hair, it always popped whenever he'd get busted open. I think that mantle might have to go to Ric Flair, I think, with the crimson mask.
Yeah, I see your point. But also, top to bottom, I'd say that this was my favorite Rumble. Rumble 2000. It featured the debut of Taz. We got the tables match between the Dudley's Hardys. We had the championship bout that I just discussed. And then we had The Rock winning his one and only Royal Rumble title. We also got to see a side of Mae Young, unfortunately, that we probably didn't need to see on that one.
You probably recorded that moment a few times and played it back, didn't you?
Who do you like for the men's Rumble, and who do you got for the women's?
I think someone from SmackDown is winning the men's side of things. It pains me to say that I think it's probably going to be Roman Reigns and have him going off facing The Fiend at WrestleMania. But the thing I'm really looking forward to in the men's Rumble is going to be who ends up eliminating Brock Lesnar. They've advertised Brock as being number one in the match, and I can't see him winning it, but I can see them pushing a big feud with whoever ends up actually eliminating him this year, and I think that's going to be Drew McIntyre, and they're going to feud on the Raw side heading into Mania, and then Roman slash somebody else from SmackDown against The Fiend on that side. To flip it to the women's side, though, I think it's going to be the returning Nia Jax is my pick to win the Women's Royal Rumble. She's been out with an injury for several months, and I think she's all healed up, and they've just been holding her off TV for just the right moment. And coming out and winning the Royal Rumble, clearing the ring, and standing tall at the end of that, I think is the right moment to bring back Nia Jax. Plus, she's not associated with either of the brands right now, so they can kind of play the who's she going to challenge kind of angle as well. So I think that's going to make for some riveting TV. So I think it's going to be Nia Jax on the women's side taking it this year.
All right, Robbie, some quick-fire Rumble trivia for you.
All right, I'm ready.
Question number one. How many wrestlers have won the Rumble in their first Rumble appearance? Their rookie Rumble, so to speak.
Rookie Rumble. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I know there was Flair. I guess Hacksaw Jim Duggan, because he was the first winner, so everyone was a rookie that year. I'm going to go with a handful. I'm going to say five.
The answer is nine.
Whew.
Believe it or not. I know, I was pretty shocked by this one, too. You had Del Rio.
Okay.
Yokozuna.
All right.
Benoit. Mm-hmm. Flair, who you said. Big John Studd in 89.
Yep. Yep.
Vinnie Mac in 99. Hacksaw, you did say, and then there was Lex Luger, who won along with Bret Hart in 1994.
Okay.
Here's another one for you. How many superstars went on to win the Rumble after drawing number one?
Number one. I feel like number one has had three winners.
Spot on.
Nice.
Wrestling Rob.
Nice.
The answer is three. You had Michaels in 95, you had Vince in 99, and then you had Benoit in 04. Ray went all the way in 2006.
Yes.
A lot of people say that that counts, but you know what? It doesn't count.
Yeah.
He was actually the number two entrant that year.
Yep.
Now, which superstar holds the unfortunate record of least time spent in a single Rumble?
That is the secretly Canadian Santino Marella.
Spot on.
Yeah.
Once again, he was eliminated in 1.9 seconds. Whew. The 2009 Rumble.
Takes a lot of skill to not last that long, I think. That's a skill he's got.
Who were the first two entrants at the first ever Royal Rumble?
I'm going to go with the Excellence of Execution, Bret the Hitman Hart, and I'm going to say another steady hand. Let's go Tito Santana.
Yes, Robbie.
Oh, nice.
They didn't get entrances in this one. Both were already in the ring when the segment began.
The old jobber entrance. Nice.
Nice work. And that was held
in 1988 at the Cops Coliseum in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada.
That's right.
Yeah.
Last question for you, Robbie. What female wrestler holds the record for longest time spent in a Rumble?
A lot of Canadians on this list. I think that's Natalia Hart, if I'm not mistaken.
Ding, ding.
Yes, there we go.
Natalia Hart. She spent 56 minutes and 1 second in the 2019 Rumble. Folks, you're going to want to bone up on your trivia because the 32nd Royal Rumble is coming Sunday, January 26th. Robbie, why don't you go ahead and tell the good folks where they can catch it and how they can follow us.
Well, like we mentioned, you can find it right here at 12 Kings. We'll be posted up, the whole Cold Canvas crew. Like I said, we're going to be doing some trivia. We're going to have some other fun games. You're going to have to come and see how those are going to work. You can find all the information on our Instagram at the Cold Canvas. That's all one word. And we gave Twitter a try. Slow and steady on that one. Again, it's the same thing. It's the Cold Canvas on Twitter as well. So be sure to check that out. We'll be posting a lot about our events, letting you know when our shows are coming up, and also some fun information from some of our sponsors will be on there as well.
Now, given the time of year, Robbie, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about football before we part ways. Mm-hmm. Wrestling Rob, my dearest friend, who do you like this year for the XFL championship?
I think it's going to be the Seattle whatever they're called. Just going to cheer for them for purely proximity reasons. I like their chances. You know, they're probably got the hotshot draft pick that everyone's talking about on ESPN and on Sportsnet. And yeah, I'm pretty sure it's going to be the Seattle whatever they're called this year, the inaugural champions.
Well, in just 6 weeks' time, the XFL season kicks off. And I'm a little bit torn, personally, because I was a big Memphis Maniac fan.
Okay.
But I think they had the best unis in all of sports. But sadly, they're not going to be returning to the league this year, I found out. So I'm going to have to side with a different team, which is going to be difficult because there are 8 teams to choose from.
Whew.
Up next, we got part 4 of our boxing podcast series. If you missed the first 3 parts, shame on you, but they are archived in the Sportsnet 650 website. Just search shows and find the Cold Canvas. Cassius Clay has turned pro. He is quickly ascending up the heavyweight ranks. And Sonny Liston is about to become the heavyweight champion of the world. Here's part 4 of the night Sonny Liston fought Cassius Clay on the Cold Canvas radio show.
I'm handsome, I'm fat, I'm pretty, and can't possibly be beat.
You might be young and handsome, but you won't be after I finish with you.
This will be the biggest outfit in the... And if you like to lose your mind, be a fool and bear on fight.
My opinion of fights are always won with fists and not with mouth talk.
And what's happened? Clay has won! Clay has won! Something has happened in Liston's corner, they're not going on. And Cassius Clay has won after 6 rounds.
Backed by his 11 white millionaire sponsors, Cassius Clay, the youngest and most coveted prize fighter in history, was quickly ascending up the heavyweight ranks and annoying the hell out of pundits and boxing fans alike with his jive talking.
Like a butterfly, sting like a bee. Ah, rumble, young man, rumble.
The man you hear screaming the famous float like a butterfly expression with Clay is one of the most interesting and often overlooked characters in the history of boxing. Unbeknownst to most, some of Ali's most famous expressions and poems did not come from him. Ali had sort of a ghostwriter, who also doubled as one of his cornermen. Drew Brown was his birth name, but history remembers him as Bandini, a legendary hype man who had a penchant for swooping into the lives of extraordinary young men and spiritually guiding them into greatness. His life story is a mythical odyssey of sorts, and it differs depending on who you ask, but the tale goes that Bandini lived on his own since the age of 10, hustling on the streets of Midway, Florida, until he joined the Marines at the ripe age of 13. He sailed the world 100 times over, and along the way he discovered boxing on the fleets. When he settled back in America, he mysteriously showed up at Sugar Ray Robinson's training camp and cornered the champion for 7 years and multiple title reigns. Bandini heard stories of a young man recently turned pro who was accurately predicting the finishes of his fights with remarkable accuracy. So, he found out where this brazen boxer was staying and showed up unannounced at his hotel door late one night. Gassius answered the door in his robe, and the second their eyes met, they stared directly into one another's souls. "You gotta be fixing them fights," Banditti started in the most serious of tones. "Ain't no way you could tell Archie Moore when he was fallen. You gotta be a phony." Clay calmly shook his head and said, "No. I know the mysteries of life," Bandini preached. "I know about men and women and love and death and the power and the glory. I ain't never heard of anybody predicting weeks in advance the round they're gonna win. So tell me the truth." "You wanna know the truth?" Clay snapped back with tears forming in his eyes. "The truth is, every time I go into the ring, I'm scared to death. All that talking I do, I know if I lose, they'll run me out of the country. I'm out there every night on a limb, and I know I got to win." Bandini began to sob uncontrollably. "I knew God was with you," he cried. And the two embraced, like lifelong brothers reunited after years of painful separation. "Now that's a fact that only you and me know," Clay said playfully. Bandini responded, "You, me, and God. You, me, and God." From that day forth, Bandini traveled everywhere with Clay. He picked out the colors of his robes and ring trunks. He wept and winced on the side of the ring apron, seemingly feeling every emotion and punch that his boxer sustained. Over the years, the two had their fair share of disputes, but their spiritual bond and brotherhood remained intact for the duration of their lives. Along with Bandini, Clay also had Angelo Dundee as his trainer. Dundee trained 15 professional champions in total through his illustrious career. This is Dundee recalling the first time the two met.
"Yeah, I was in a Sheraton hotel, minding my own business. Willie Pastrana had a fight on, and I get a call from the lobby from guy says, 'Hey, I'm Cassius Marcellus Clay, I'm the Gold Glove champ. Louisville, Kentucky, I won the Golden Gloves. In Seattle, I won the Golden Gloves. In Chicago, I'm going to be the next Olympic champion.' So I held my hand to the phone. I said, 'Willie, is some kind of a nut downstairs who wants to talk to us?'"
I had a lot of fighters. I had about 16 fighters. You know, I was working with Carmen, Louis, Willie Pastrana, Dufas. I said, "Look, I got a gym in Miami Beach. If you ever want to come down and train, come on." He said, "Man," he said, "everybody's offering me money, cars." All I can offer you is service.
Clay always boasted that he and he alone was responsible for his accolades and success. Sure, he'd credit Sugar Ray and other long-retired fighters for inspiring his in-ring style and techniques, but mainly Clay wanted to publicly acknowledge his originality. Quote, "When you talk about who made me, you talk to me. Who made me is me."
Muhammad had a very strong personality. He liked to do things his way. He would never have lasted with a trainer who insisted on complete control.
Dundee always acknowledged that he had to be clever with Clay. If he demanded that Clay moved or hit a certain way, he'd almost always do the opposite. In fact, Ali's boxing style went completely against the traditional methods of success. He would circle towards the power sides of his opponent's punches as opposed to away, and he simply refused to ever throw body shots. So, Dundee implemented reverse psychology tactics, and his demands took the form of suggestions, and in turn, Clay could then conceive that these suggestions were his own ideas. Dundee was a master of trickery, and his unassuming demeanor made his talent for deception that much more effective. This is a great story. It's a side tale, but I'm going to tell it. Prior to the Rumble in the Jungle Tilt with Foreman, Dundee brought a spoke and a wrench into the ring and went from turnbuckle to turnbuckle, loosening the ropes in plain sight of everybody watching. For whatever reason, nobody said a thing. And when the ropes were slack enough for Ali to execute his rope-a-dope effectively, He left the ring and casually went back to his corner and awaited Foreman's entrance.
The greatest upsets in the sport. Clay over Liston, Ollie over Foreman, Leonard over Haggard. And in every situation, there in the corner, was Angelo Dundee.
Cassius could claim all day that he and he alone made him who he was. But the Prince of Heaven had his angels. And if it were not for them, perhaps Clay would not have received his first title shot as quickly as he did. For it was Clay's blind arrogance that landed him on the mat in the fourth round, struggling to get to his corner for the very first time in his career against Englishman Henry Cooper. First, let's go back to Cheminski Park in Chicago, Illinois. This is champion Floyd Patterson versus challenger Sonny Liston.
Cheminski Park, Chicago. This is Chris Schenkel at the site of the most lucrative fight in the history of boxing. 27-year-old Floyd Patterson defends the heavyweight championship of the world against 28-year-old Sonny Liston.
For the world heavyweight boxing title, weighing 214 pounds, wearing the white and black trunks, from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Sonny Liston. Weighing 189 pounds, wearing the black and white trunks, from Yonkers, New York, the world heavyweight boxing champion, Floyd Patterson. Referee Frank Sikora will now give instructions.
The massive challenger, 25 pounds heavier than the champion, has a 13-inch reach advantage. The champion is restless in his corner, the challenger placid. Sonny Liston moves out to face the big chance of his 28 years of a turbulent life. Patterson's plan is to get inside Liston's long jab and work on the challenger's body. Liston's heavy jabs bother Patterson. Patterson's bobbing and weaving make Liston miss often. The challenger takes any available target. The Liston hook to the head is the first good punch of the fight. The challenger moving in. The champion shaking off the effect of that left hook. A left, a grazing right, and a solid left to the cheekbone drop the champion.
The winner and the new world heavyweight boxing champion, Sonny Liston.
Around Sonny Liston, the 21st heavyweight champion of the world, jubilation for Floyd Patterson, the former champion, consolation.
And that was it. It took only 2 minutes and 10 seconds for the most prestigious title in American sports to fall into the hands of its most reviled athlete. Charles Sonny Liston, the plantation boy from Sanslough, Arkansas, was now the heavyweight champion of the world.
Welcome back to the Cold Canvas Radio Show. Get your cut man ready and get your hands up, because here's your host, Big Al Brody, and he's coming in swinging on Sportsnet 650.
And welcome back to the Cold Canvas Radio Show. I'm sitting here with Coach Casey of Gracie Baja. We're just kicking it here at 12 Kings Pub, Vancouver's one and only home of combat sports. It's a brand new year, so many of you out there, you've made your resolutions to get into shape this year. Sign up at Gracie Baja, you receive your free month of training, and trust me, you will. And that is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to studying jiu-jitsu. You're going to not only transform physically, you're also going to transform mentally, spiritually. You're going to develop a whole new perspective on the world. Professor, thank you so much for coming by.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Yeah. So jiu-jitsu for you was not your introduction to martial arts. It wasn't your first sport, right?
No, that's right. Boxing. Boxing was the first thing. Just learning how to punch things and not get punched was my first thing.
And what made you kind of transition over to jiu-jitsu?
It was a situation of what was available at the time. My coach, my boxing coach, moved to L.A., and the gym I was training at also did no-gi grappling, some MMA-style grappling. So I just decided to stay at that gym and try the thing that I saw all these guys and girls coming in and doing anyways, because I had a good relationship with that gym. So it started there. No-gi, just the rash guard and the shorts and a lot of wrestling, takedowns and chokes and stuff. And I kind of fell in love with it right away, to be honest. It was so different from boxing, but it really employed some of the natural abilities that I already had, some flexibility and strength that I already had. And I found that I didn't mind being so close to other people, you know, because that's the thing that people complain about, not wanting to do jiu-jitsu. It's like, oh, I don't want to be so close to people. But you know what? It's not that big of a deal.
What would you say is the most satisfying feeling in jiu-jitsu for you? What's the kind of juice that keeps you hooked and coming
back? I love this question because it sounds like it's a cop-out, but honestly, just doing jiu-jitsu is the best feeling. Mm-hmm. Showing up, seeing my friends that I'm about to spar with and have a good time with rolling around in our pajamas trying to kill each other, and then once that class is over, I'm even happier. Like, there's no bad feelings for me when it comes to doing jiu-jitsu. I love physically difficult things. It's my favorite way to socialize. I'm not like a big let's sit around and chat kind of socializer. I like to do things. Mm-hmm. And so jiu-jitsu is perfect because you get that. I love the feeling of community, hanging out with a bunch of people, and we're all interested in the same thing. And it just so happens that the thing we're interested in is choking each other and breaking each other's arms and all of those kind of fun things. But it's like the funnest hour of my day. Absolutely. I just the act of doing jiu-jitsu is my favorite thing about jiu-jitsu.
Did you have any issues with being tapped out those first 6 months to a year?
Yeah.
Did it bother you? Were there moments where you thought, like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this. I don't know if I want to come back.
Yeah. I would say it's fair to say that for the first year or more, maybe even the first year and a half to 2 years, I was full of a little bit of, should I or shouldn't I go to the gym today? Yeah, it took a...
Because you're super competitive, right?
I'm a competitive guy. I'm not a big guy either. Anybody listening, I sound super huge and tough, but actually, I'm 5'7", 145 pounds. So it definitely took more willpower for the first couple of years to show up on a regular schedule. I do believe in regular training. Making a schedule and sticking to it is a huge thing that I recommend when starting any physical practice. But jiu-jitsu, yeah, it was going somewhere to get my butt kicked over and over. And the willpower to go is a huge part of jiu-jitsu. Developing that willpower of dealing with adversity, dealing with the fact that you're not the best at something, but going anyways, like, that's a lesson that I can't put enough money into. I can't put a price on that is what I mean. It takes less willpower for me now. I love going now. I look forward to getting smashed by Professor Marcos, who's, you know, way larger than me. You know, there's always going to be guys that are going to beat me. I know that, and I love it. I look forward to it. But it doesn't stress me out like it did when I first started. So I guess there's a bit of, you have to have that part of you that enjoys doing difficult things. I think you do have to have that mentality going into it, but you can certainly develop that mentality by just sticking with the difficult thing, and it just gets better. You know, you get better at what you practice. So
we could just talk about promotions for 1 second. Mm-hmm. One color belt to the next, what type of skills kind of a person must possess to graduate from that white belt to the blue belt?
White belt to blue belt is an interesting kind of year of your life. I say year because with regular training, that's usually about how long it takes. But of course, if you take breaks or don't train as often, it can take longer. But I don't know. A lot of people want to go back to being white belt because it feels like it's gone so fast. But it feels like the main, if I could break it down to the main skill between white and blue belt, is relaxing. I think white belts typically get criticized for being way too tense and way too focused on strength as their main attribute. But, you know, maybe that's the main attribute that you have. You don't have the techniques yet. So from white belt to blue belt, you really learn how to calm down and how to use mechanics, body mechanics, and physics instead of just pure muscle strength. So I'd say that's the main difference between a white and a blue belt, is just the sense of calm and the sense of, like, plan. Blue belts tend to have a little bit more of a plan when you spar with them. White belts, it's really anything could happen. So I actually like sparring brand new white belts because it feels a little bit more authentic of an actual fight, like an actual situation where someone maybe is trying to hurt me, but they don't really know what to do, but they know that if they grab my arm, they could hurt my arm, or if they grab my neck, they could hurt my neck. But it's not technique, but it is a little intimidating sometimes to deal with a big white belt, you know? So it tests my ability to stay calm, my ability to use the techniques that I know. And when I can pull them off, then I know, oh, that really works. You know, that really works against someone when they don't quite know what's up, but they're perhaps stronger than me or bigger than me, which is probably always going to be the case if someone wants to beat me up on the street. It's not going to be someone smaller than me. It's probably going to be someone bigger. So, so I enjoy sparring with white belts for the reasons that I love them and for the reasons that I don't love them.
Do you think someone who's just beginning shouldn't put so much emphasis and importance on being promoted from one color to the next?
Absolutely. I don't think that should be the mindset ever. Mm-hmm. Is to you know, the belts are there to give you a sense of progress and a sense of a path that you're following and maybe a goal. Sure, it's good to have goals, but definitely I don't. The belt holds your gi together, and it looks nice when you tie it nicely. But otherwise, it's just one more thing for someone to hold on to and use against you. So it really doesn't matter what color it is. It's a great way to organize a class and a great way to organize your skill and obviously organize competition. You have to have belts, but no, it shouldn't be the focus of anyone. You should just do jiu-jitsu and don't worry about the belts at all.
Now, before you skedaddle on your Rasputin helmet, I have to ask you what you thought of the Connor tilt over the weekend. Because when we last spoke, you hit it right on the nose.
Did I?
Oh, yeah. You said round one. Wow. I think you said 39 seconds.
Well, I... yeah, right. I wish. I was surprised at how fast it went. I do think that McGregor was trying to take Masvidal's record with that. He threw that enormous left hand, almost, you know, fell over Cerrone after he threw that left hand. So I'm pretty sure he did that. Maybe he was just, you know, how many months did he have off? Maybe it's just that. But also, I think he kind of wanted to take that Masvidal record. And then those shoulder shots, I don't think anybody's ever done shoulder shots in the center of the cage like that. Usually they do it against the fence. But never.
Yeah, I don't think that's ever happened.
Never with that much power. I mean, he busted his nose with the second one, and then the third one was just a little extra. I think it would have been a faster knockout if he'd landed with his shin, but that foot connected right with his jaw. I remember watching McGregor years ago, videos of him working just hitting pads precisely with his feet with all his different kicks, and there's no question how precise he is with his kicks. It wasn't an accident that he hit with the foot, but man, if he landed with that shin, there would have been no extra shots. It would have been a knockout. It's good to have him back
the king is back, it's fair to say.
And I like this guy. You know, it's hard to support a guy when you're doing all this outside of the ring stuff. I mean, whatever, people are going to make mistakes and party too much and it's okay, but I like this guy a lot better and I'm much more interested in supporting this Conor McGregor than I was the Conor McGregor of a year ago or whatever, you know. So it's good to have him back for the sport. And Donald Cerrone is you know, okay. He's made a lot of money, but I'm sure he wanted it to go longer. And I kind of did too, but it was pretty amazing to watch. You know, I had to watch it 3 or 4 times to really enjoy it. But yeah, what a fight.
Well, it's good to have you back on the show. Thanks for coming back.
You know what? Anytime, man. I love talking jiu-jitsu. I love talking physical activity. Get out there. Whatever it is you want to do or have an interest in, just do it. Get out there and do it consistently, and you will not regret it. Do difficult things. No matter what size you are, what gender you are, what age you are, Come and train. You'll have the best time ever.
And Gracie Baja also offers martial arts classes for kids from the ages of 3 to 14, also offering self-defense classes and women's-only programs. For more, you can just hit up their Facebook account at Gracie Baja Vancouver, and they now have an Instagram account as well, at Gracie Baja Vancouver. Professor, thank you so much again.
Absolutely. It's Coach. I can't accept the mantle of professor yet, but I appreciate it.
And that's it for us, folks. The Cold Canvas crew looks forward to seeing you at the Royal Rumble. We're going to be presenting that event right here at 12 Kings Pub. And be sure to send us any questions you may have for Raven on Instagram at The Cold Canvas, because he is going to be joining us on our next episode. You don't want to end up in Dirt Nap City, folks. So until then, keep your hands up. Big Al Brody, signing out.